Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create.
Hello and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast all about leaving the EU. I think I'll start this week's podcast by saying, no matter what deal is struck with the EU, this podcast will continue to be excellent. I am joined, as always, by Christian Spence. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
And Alex Davis.
Hello.
Right, gents, we've got four or five key topics to get into today, but why don't we go with the one which I feel like we've done it over and over again, which is customs union and the comments from Liam Fox, the business secretary, about the customs union.
Yeah. Do you want to start this or do I want to start this?
It's pretty easy to wrap up what he said. He's once again reiterated that he thinks that we should not only be not in the customs union, but that we shouldn't be in any form of customs union whatsoever with the EU post-Brexit, because it limits our ability to have our own independent trade policy, is what he said.
Now, I don't need to know too much about this other than to say, from the Chamber's point of view, I assume you're dead against this.
Dead against what? Which bit?
Leaving the customs union.
We've said it's... Actually, our position hasn't... We've not talked a lot about the customs union in terms, but the membership think it's an important aspect. And the basic reason why... We talked about this in detail last week, actually, so I won't dwell on it now, but encourage listeners to go back and listen to the previous one. It's the fact that we don't manufacture complete capital goods in this UK. We're part of integrated supply chains. So even if we came outside the customs union, even if we got a really good free trade deal with the EU, we would still be, and traders would still be, on the hook for rules of origin requirements. And that's a huge, huge bureaucratic barrier.
The thing I don't get about this Liam Fox thing is, how hard is it to have one single message on Brexit? I mean, why is he saying something which is new? And why is it coming from Liam Fox rather than Theresa May, who's having more and more control over Brexit, and ultimately David Davis, who should be in control of Brexit?
I don't know. You tell me.
I think the question is who is in control of Brexit, and we don't know. And this kind of goes back to, I guess this is kind of a running theme, probably through every single podcast we've ever done, is the, you know, one of the things we've talked about, there is no government position. We know that there is no government position, because Theresa May has decided what she wants. She drew her three red lines randomly in the sand at the Lancaster House speech. We know that Theresa May wants one thing, David Davis wants another, Liam Fox wants another, Boris Johnson wants another, Jacob Rees-Mogg says we just, you know, torch the place and run. The Chancellor says it should be close integration. There isn't a government position, and this is essentially really why, you know, I think that's like my private view, certainly an increasingly public view, is in the negotiations we will basically end up with what the EU wants, because the EU's position is blisteringly clear and hasn't shifted. So actually, while we're still trying to nail jelly to a wall, the EU knows what it wants to
get. It's just worth pointing out as well, this customs union question is so far from being answered. There's an amendment just been shelved by Anna Sowbury and a whole bunch of other MPs, which stipulates that we need to maintain a customs union in the form that we currently have today, post-Brexit. So there are, you know, there's so much division over it, and I have no confidence that any of them have a great grasp of what they're actually talking about. Because
I'm sure you'd be hard-pushed to find five MPs who could tell you what the customs union actually does.
We should do a randomised sample.
Yeah, it would be cool, but no, it's a... I'm so frustrated talking about this, and I can't even string a sentence together.
I'm constantly amazed that Theresa May is in a a weak position. You would say a classically weak position.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I actually think she's in a fairly strong position, because the threat of her government coming down almost will certainly lead to a Labour government or some such thing.
Yeah.
Her strength should be her weakness. I could see her being weaker if she had a large majority, but a majority of that majority were hard Brexiteers. That would be much, much worse. Which is why I'm so confused that Liam Fox can't just simply say, refer to the memo, or refer to David Davis, or we don't know. That would be perfectly acceptable
exactly.
as well.
Exactly, but I'd say actually, I wouldn't even say no, because I wouldn't say I don't know is unacceptable at this stage, 18 months after triggering Article 50, or 18 months after a referendum and 12, whenever all this stuff happened. Because we're at the point now, we've seen the European Union has now published its negotiating guidelines for transition. Those are now ready. And of course, you know, I think we've joked about this before. The UK government has been saying all the way through phase one, come on, we're going to get to phase two, we've got to talk about it. We're at the point now within days where the EU will say, okay, so what do you want? And we don't know. We don't know what we want. All we know is we want a relationship which is deep and special. Which is not something you can draw up a, you know, bilateral international treaty on.
No, it's crazy. And I don't get Liam Fox's obsession with you know, the whole having our independent trade policy thing, because
in fact, his international trade minister is
it's his job, yeah. But I mean, we spoke about last week about the impact that trade agreements actually have is very, very small.
Yes,
Especially the type of countries which we will want to be negotiating our own trade deals with, because the EU doesn't already have them. You know.
There's marginal benefit to the UK overall in those additions.
Just slightly linked to this, I guess, and if you want to comment on it quickly, please do. Theresa May dashed over to China this week.
Absolutely, yeah. More deep and special relationships. Because there's quite a few articles this week in the press, big one in the FT this morning, or yesterday, which is talking about actually the relationship on China's investment into the UK does appear to be cooling. So a number of projects appear in the northwest, particularly, where, you know, proposed to Chinese investment appears to have never actually come through. So that, you know, a lot of work that was done really with Osborne and Cameron and President Xi in the early days of the Paris really does appear to have softened off.
Now, that is stuff like Airport City. I believe that's Chinese, is it not?
It is. That's Chinese Beijing Investment or Engineering Group. That's still ploughing ahead. No problem there. But there is, I think, a £150 million project at World Waters, which is due to be Chinese funded, which appears to have gone cold.
Now, when is it Chinese funded? What does this actually mean?
Essentially Chinese investors. So it is Chinese capital.
So, for instance,
mostly private.
They threw up this building here. They can sell it. They get capital gain.
Exactly.
They get the rent.
They receive yield in any other way. But that's partially from my Chinese government as well, which is currently trying to. It's getting a little bit jumpy about the amount of capital that's flowing out of the country as China's expanded its reach globally. The Chinese government is now encouraging Chinese firms to think about investing in the domestic market.
So, for a city like Manchester, what are the downsides to having inflows of Chinese money, particularly if it's owned by people like the government, or is it private investment?
It's mostly private investment, though. I think, you know, I'm no Chinese economist, but I think lots will tell you it's a blurrier line in China, probably private than it is here in the UK. It's overseas capital, like anything else. You know, it's good investment. It allows, you know, things to happen here without needing UK capital and UK banking support to do that. The downside, of course, that means the returns on that capital flow overseas. So it's got an impact on UK current account.
Right. Well, that was quite an enjoyable little tangent. From capital leaking out of China to information leaking out of the government, there was actually a leak regarding, is it an impact assessment? Have I got that correct?
Yeah, it was a Brexit forecast, I guess you could say. It was leaked by a guy at BuzzFeed, I think.
They got hold of it first.
Originally, I actually don't know too much about the source of this. This was a paper that was written by the civil service, I presume.
Yep. It appears to have cross-departmental approval. Yeah.
Yeah. So they've all seen it.
Now, is this one of those impact assessments that don't exist?
No. These definitely exist. But it's not one of those ones that David Davis is commissioning. Yeah, this appears to have come from Government Economic Service, the GES. So it is the civil services. Cross-departmental, cross-ministerial branch.
I mean, the reason why this leak hasn't been particularly useful, I don't think, like many things in the Brexit process, it hasn't been particularly productive in pushing the conversation forward, because it looked again at the three broad routes which everyone can guess, so WTO, something like Norway, something like Canada. The results of it were that all of them would negatively impact the economy in relation to not Brexiting at all, with the WTO being the worst impact and Norway being the least worst impact. The numbers were not far off what the figures were from the impact assessments which came up before the referendum. So it really hasn't told us anything new particularly. I mean, perhaps the most interesting point about it is that they tried to hide it, and that the government has said that the reason that they didn't want this to become public is because it looks at the same three scenarios that have been looked at many times before, and that they want something completely bespoke, so it doesn't really represent what they're going for.
So where would bespoke fall into this range of scenarios?
Well, this perhaps is a problem more widely with trying to, you know, assess the impacts of the three scenarios, is that we're not going to get any of them exactly. You know, even if we go down the WTO route, there'll be multiple agreements on top of that, which means that it really isn't no deal, like the true no deal, as we've said before. Yeah. If we go down the route like Canada, we won't end up with a deal which is exactly the same as CETA. It'll be tailored to us in some way. Again, Norway will be based on something like the EEA, which has specific, specific agreements for each country that's party to it. So, whatever we get, it will be bespoke. It's a rubbish point that's being made by the government, because we know that they're looking broadly at going down the Canada or the Norway route. We've said before that it's not a spectrum; that they're kind of a distinct set of tools. Each one of them is, and we'll open that box and use those tools to tailor it to us. So for them to say that the report's not relevant because they're going for a bespoke deal is a bit nuts, because you could never do an impact assessment on their bespoke deal, because none of us have a clue what it is yet. If we're going to...
Including our government.
Yeah, if we're going to try and box it into options, those would be the best three.
All right, so give me something to be optimistic about then. Is there any scenario that either of you can see where the UK would be better off outside of the EU? Has this assessment really take into account all the options, or is it just taken into account the sort of the mainstream options?
It's taken into account the mainstream options, and I don't know what time frame it's looking at, but is there an option which would leave us better off in the short term? No. I don't even think Brexiteers would say that there is.
No, indeed, absolutely.
Long term, I mean, you know, you're just guessing then.
That's it. I mean, I think the challenge is, you know, number one, moving away. Yeah, increasing frictions between the UK and its single biggest trade partner is going to have a negative effect. That, you know, on its own, that's very, very clear. It's very hard to measure. Depends on how you want to do it. And actually, the estimates in this report were between -2% and -8% of GDP in 15 years' time. That's where we're broadly where we're looking. So 2% lower than it would be if we'd stayed in for Norway. 8% lower than it would be in 15 years than if we'd go for WTA. What it did do, actually, which is interesting, and whilst I think we've seen them before, the wider public might not, is it also reiterates the potential benefits to trade deals that we would then be able to strike outside of that. And Alex talked a little bit about this last week. And of course, actually, it's been long known that a trade deal between the UK and the US, it was last, I think the Treasury did a huge report on it back in about 2013. It's about it's just under 0.5% of GDP over 15 years, which is basically zero to any, you know, any significant amount. And if you do the same with India and China, you come up with basically the same kind of numbers. And that's because we model trade on a gravity model, which is basically actually very, very long distance trade in huge volumes. Doesn't happen because it's a long way away.
Yeah.
It's just that straightforward. You know, there's a reason corporates work in kind of regional clusters around the world, you know, Americas, Europe and North Africa, East Asia, Australasia, because being close matters. So actually, you know, even if you go for, you know, the least damaging scenario, which allows you to do your own trade deals, which will put you at Canada, which is about -5, no amount of additional trade deals with the countries would ever make up that gap. That's the clear bit,
really. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a little bit like most of our trade goes to Ireland or some such thing. I mean, it's not the biggest country, it just happens to be the closest.
It just happens to be closest, exactly. That's the important point.
Tricky one. Now, I always wonder with the EU. I mean, it seems to... When you talk about trade deals, that's, you know, effectively, you know, we'll accept this under these rules, and it, the more trade deals you accept, the more and more complex all the various trade rules become. Mm-hmm. Now, for my basic A-level economics classes, I remember them talking about the WTO, and actually the whole point of that is to cut regulation. Do you think, as an alternative to Brexit, and this is kind of outside-the-box thinking, the EU would just be better off to go through a round of regulation cutting over and over again? Because this can't be the best way to do it.
It depends what you mean by regulation, and I think there's an argument to say that what the WTO is, it reduces regulation by increasing it almost.
It reduces frictions.
Yes, yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
But it seems like for every new regulation you put in, it's this whole other framework, which is kind of, and then you've got to deal with all the different laws of unintended consequences and, you know, impacts on markets which you never expected. I just can't see it being the best way.
No, and I think this is sort of, I think it's one of those things where, I think we talked before about David Alan Green, one of our favourite commentators, always from the FT, and he talks about, you know, one of the biggest mistakes the UK has made in the whole Brexit process is pretending it's simple.
Yeah.
When actually this is extremely complex. Is most people, and I would include most economists and most global analysts, massively underestimate how incredibly complex, protectionist, and downright dirty international trade is.
Yeah.
You know, everyone, again, we talked about this in the very early podcast, I think, you know, that for most people who live in Europe, we never see the dirtiness of international trade because we are essentially cosseted inside the world's largest single market. So we don't see a lot of it. But, you know, there's been the trade disputes with Bombardier recently. US is going for all sorts of trade disputes, or starting trade disputes, on the back of trying to block steel from China, etc., etc. There's loads of, it's a very, very dirty world. And the WTO, born as it was out of GATT, GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, WTO came into formation in the 90s. And it's basically on about setting some basic minimum standards by which everyone abides by to try and get rid of some of that dirtiness. There's still a lot of it because there's a lot to play for. You know, there are, even if we take the Patrick Minford of the Economist for Free Trade or whatever they're now called report, even his scenario, which says, you know, actually Brexit will liberate the UK economy, allow it to do all sorts of stuff. Don't forget, his estimate for forecast for GDP was for 2.7% last year, which is about as out as some of the other economists in the other direction. But he said that would pretty much eradicate manufacturing and agriculture in the UK. Yeah. These are the kind of stakes that are at play when you open your markets up to competition from people who can do it much, much cheaper than you.
But, I mean, that's kind of the point. We want it cheaper. We want it aimed at the consumer. I know we've had this conversation before, but
yeah.
As long as the consumer wins, everyone wins.
But if that consumer is then unemployed, then they don't have any money to go and buy the goods, even if they are cheaper. So it's all of those trends. You're essentially revisiting the, you know, the deindustrialisation of the 1970s, the agricultural reforms of the 1950s, the Luddite reforms of the 19th century. You're revisiting all those arguments afresh each time. So there's a lot to lose. You know, the Bombardier Boeing dispute in Northern Ireland, which the EU has won for us.
Yeah. Well, it's not been resolved, has it not?
There was something passed last week.
In a US court?
But whatever the detail, I can't remember, I've not seen the detail on the trade, but it looks like it's going out of favour anyway. You know, there is an entire industry at stake that hangs on how that goes. You know, this is not just, you know, we might narrow our margins here. That could put a hole through Bombardier or Airbus or Boeing's sheer existence in the market or not.
So I don't think when people talk about, we'll go back to the customs union, I don't think people understand that the implications of leaving the customs union in one go would go both ways. So, like, I came across another video which made me angry today, and it's really old.
Ooh.
But I've seen it before.
So what's the video?
Of Jacob Rees-Mogg saying we need to come out of the customs union because it's a protectionist racket which protects producers in rich companies.
Yeah, rich countries, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He does have a point, though.
But there is truth in that statement.
Yeah, because he uses the example of coffee beans. So the duty on green coffee beans is zero, but the duty on roasted coffee beans is 7.5% or something like that. So basically we don't give the African countries which produce the beans the opportunity to roast them because the Italians and the Germans want to roast them.
Which is where the value is, of course.
Yeah, exactly. I've got lots of problems with this statement. First of all, there's a thing called Everything But Arms, which gives the 50... I think there's about 50 countries who are basically the least developed countries in the world, gives them total tariff, everything free access to the single market on everything but arms.
So the countries which
he's probably talking about already can send things freely to us. Then the second problem with it is that if we were to just leave...
Hang on, everything but arms and roasted coffee beans.
Everything but arms, yeah, everything.
So roasted coffee, so yeah, so coffee beans is included in that.
They can send it without tariffs.
So is there a tariff or is there not a tariff?
There's not a tariff. On everything but arms, there is no tariff.
It's from those 50 least developed countries.
He's obviously picked a country where there is a tariff. Certainly more developed.
The biggest importers of green coffee into the EU is Brazil and Vietnam, I think.
It's not Ethiopia?
I think they're third.
Okay.
I think Brazil and Vietnam make up like something like 40% of the imports or something like that. But the point I was going to make anyway is that...
Sorry.
If you leave the customs union... Yeah, maybe he's got a point, but there would then all of a sudden be a massive realignment in our own economy, because all of a sudden our exports to the EU would be subjected to all these tariffs too, and then we can't retaliate them against them because of we've all spoken about MFN clauses before, meaning that if we retaliate against those tariffs, we have to put those same tariffs against everyone else, and so all of our exporters all of a sudden have to face up to the same tariffs that he's complaining about, and industries would... It just...
Exactly. It's the old thing. There's two sides. On every policy decision, there's two sides.
It's a trade-off, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's also... there's also the small fact that they're going to have to pour, quite literally, maybe millions of tonnes of concrete to actually build all the things and the infrastructure to do this.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So you have to build yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, yeah, and that sort of comes back to the, are we genuinely preparing for the new deal, which has been sort of wrapping around the news this week.
But yes.
There's a great
little story which I loved about, I can't remember the exact name of it. Was it the Road Haulage and Trucking Bill?
Something like that.
Something like that. So, in an attempt to show that we are really preparing for no deal, the civil service actually wrote up a bill which would cover the future of road haulage and trucking in a WTO option world.
Yeah.
And it's being shelved because it made no deal look so bad.
Really?
Yeah, because what they found was so bad. And so, in an attempt to show that we're being serious about the threat of no deal, we've actually shelved it because it made them realise how bad it is.
Have you been lucky enough to get a copy of this bill, or is it shelved?
I don't have the time to get through stuff like that.
Well, if someone does. Okay, well, there was a story doing the rounds about a guy called Steve, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and someone else who you were trying to tell me about.
Steve Baker MP.
Right, so you have to tell me all from the start about what this is.
This is only just a little political...
I quite enjoyed it, though.
...story. This was going back to the leaked impact report, whatever it's called. Jacob Rees-Mogg asked a question in Parliament where he implied somewhat that the Treasury had been messing around with the numbers to make this report tell the story that it's really bad if we leave the customs union, so that they'd been being selective with their numbers, essentially.
So this leaked report was basically doctored, or wasn't as authentic as you might wish.
That's what Jacob Rees-Mogg was implying. And then Steve Baker answered saying that he had heard from a guy called Charles Grant, who works for the Centre for European Reform, at a conference or a party or something like that. He'd heard a similar story, and that he'd heard on the grapevine that they'd been messing with the numbers to make it show what they want. And then loads of other people who were there came out and said, that's not what he said at all. Don't put that on Charles Grant. He didn't say that. And Steve Baker said, well, I think he did say that. And then Number 10 came out and said, we have no reason not to believe Steve Baker's version of events. And everyone was saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if a recording of this conversation came out?
Well, what do you know?
And a recording of the conversation did come out, and Charles Grant did not say that, and then Steve Baker had to issue an apology.
I have many, many conversations most days. Not one of them that I know of is actually recorded. I mean, I don't know how they get... I mean, if I even had the slightest doubt that my conversation was recorded, I don't think that I would fabricate any part of it whatsoever.
Yeah, well, that's example two that we've spoken about today of of government having more than one position on a particular thing. And then the third one, which we probably should probably mention, is that there was a letter which went out to businesses written by Dexu. It had David Davis's name on it, Liam Fox on it, name on it. It was a letter to businesses ensuring them continuity for the transition period, saying our intention is that everything will remain the same, don't worry, immigration will continue as before during the transition period. So this letter was sent out to businesses, and then less than a week later, Theresa May came out and said, actually, I don't want freedom of movement to continue as before during the transition period. Said something that was the opposite of what this letter to businesses had said. And then the EU instantly came back and said, no, you can't do that. We've already told you it's got to be maintained as it is throughout the transition period. So that was literally within 10 days.
If the Department for Brexit did anything, it should just be to qualify statements. That's all it should be. If you're going to say something, you need to get it. It baffles me. It absolutely baffles me.
Yep, this is the story of this is really why I think so many of us on the kind of the analyst side of all this are just, you know, we're reading less because it's
getting tired of it. Yeah,
it's just grunt. The government is making the most difficult political policy choice that the UK has gone through in decades, as difficult as it can possibly make it. And this is just so insane. You know, this was always going to be difficult. Even if, you know, with the best will in the world and an astonishing set of political leaders and the unanimity of the public and business in supporting, it was still going to be horrendously hard. But at every single step, Theresa May and the upper echelons of the cabinet are just doing everything they can to make it infinitely harder than it has to be. And that's just depressing.
I just wonder, from a pure political strategy point of view, whether you should just... It's going to make a sports analogy then, but it might be wasted here, so I won't.
Well, it'd be wasted with me. The listeners and Alex, I'm sure, will understand. But
I just wonder if it's worth just blowing the whole thing up. Letting a very weak Labour government destroy themselves on the rocks of Brexit, and then... for the Tory party to regather later on.
Just throw the towel in.
Look, it's just not for us. It isn't for us. Go back to the country, hope for a loss, and then just let Labour pick up the pieces. Because I just can't imagine. I mean, I would love to see the Labour attempts at this also. Because it might actually be.
The problem is the position is no more coherent than.
Because it doesn't have to be. Yeah.
No, I mean, they might be a bit more disciplined. I mean, you simply just don't know. So that's kind of how despondent I am at the moment. Now, I've just got a question here which I've written down, and all it says is, "Why am I outraged?" So, the "Why am I outraged?" Question is the talk about potential sanctions if the UK goes its own way and decides to do something as outrageous as lower its own taxes or cut its own regulation.
Yeah. So this is... do you want to pick up on?
I don't know anything about this.
Okay.
So why am I outraged at...
outraged of Chawton, sat opposite me, is furious because the EU has said it is preparing for and considering whether it might need to, in the concept of the future relationship between the EU27 and the UK, have the availability for sanctions or trade mediation of some form to challenge any position which it considers for the UK is over competitive, I guess. And there's been two kind of responses to this, really. One is very similar to Mr. Outrage of Jordan, which is basically, how dare the EU get to this point? How does this help, you know, our you know, coming together to try and form a mutually beneficial future relationship? And the other one is the usual one from some of the analyst side, who said, actually, this makes perfect sense because of the kind of special case. So let's talk a little bit through that. So the EU's position on this is, I guess, is twofold. One, any deal with the UK, assuming the UK is a third country, which it will be in a year and a bit, any deal with the UK will have to be very different from anything it's done with anybody else, because it's never had a trade deal with an economy as large, as strong, and as physically close.
Yeah.
So all those things we talk about gravity trade models, all the rest of it, with the fifth, depending on how you do the exchange rates, the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. Only Germany in the EU is larger than that. So we're a slightly special case. It's not done anything of this scale before. The second one, of course, is that the EU's point of view, the UK wants a deep and special relationship. We don't know what that means, but we can read into that. We know that the UK government's position on the whole is that it wants something better than a plain FTA, a plain free trade agreement. It wants some form of additional preferential access into the single market. It certainly wants it on financial services, though it appears it's not going to get it. So the EU is saying, well, okay, but if you're wanting something more than a basic FTA, then we have to put protections in which are greater than a normal FTA. So if you imagine the analogy now, the free trade agreement with Canada needs very little in terms of sanction and corrective measures. There are some in there for the little bits of services that throws in, and dispute resolution. But actually, you don't need a great deal because it's a long way away. It's never going to be massively penetrating in the market. It's relatively small scale, so we don't need to worry. The UK's position is not only is an FTA, but inside a customs union, and crucially inside a single market, which means the EU has to absolutely enforce a level playing field between the EU27 and the UK as we stand today. So there's all forms of sanction that are available. The EU can fine the UK government. We have state aid protection. We have health and safety protection. All of that stuff. So essentially what the EU is saying is saying, well, look, if you want something in between CETA and single market, which is essentially what we are saying, then you need to accept that the sanctions and mediation regime has to be somewhere in between CETA and the single market. So
these are basically, rather than sanctions, you know, as you might hear them against, you know, Iran or North Korea.
Sanctions is too big a word because, sanctions, I think, to most of us means we're going to put full-blown trade embargoes in place. What is the question of? He's saying, well, actually, if you want better access, if you want to get some kind of services access for the UK economy, preferential access into the EU, then actually we can't have the UK government subsidising its firms willy-nilly because that is giving you an advantage. So we will, in that deal, there will have to be some form of state aid.
So interestingly, I mean, we spoke about what would Labour do in this position. I mean, this would be one of the things that they just could not accept.
Well, it varies on your position, I think. So this is, you would say, because of course Labour's position is it wants to
buy everything.
Yeah, nationalise it if it moves. Of course, the thing is the EU does not have any problem with nationalisation. Indeed, if you go and see, the big one is Corbyn won't be able to nationalise the railways because we're in the EU. Except the point that every other European nation has its train services nationalised.
They're nationalised, but they have to run along the same lines. Excuse the pun of competition rule. They've got to behave
exactly. So separate balance sheets, separate P&L. That's the crucial part. So they are as to who owns it. I mean, this is for me is actually a very nicely pragmatic economic point. I'm not a pro-nationalisation, pro-sector. Theoretically, who sits behind it kind of shouldn't matter. It's about how it's run and how the incentives are gained. So all the EU rules say is what you can't have is the government running, East Coast Rail in the UK, and that East Coast Rail franchise is being propped up by its ability to hoover additional corporation tax revenue out of the gas industry.
Yeah. And I guess the problem is railways don't really compete.
No, that's it. They come into a classification where economists call public goods, natural monopolies, essentially. So there is. So, but that's it. So people said we had to privatise Royal Mail a couple of years ago to comply with the postal directive.
You
don't need to privatise it. You just need to separate it.
Now that might be
actually owns the shares.
Royal Mail. That kind of example might be more problematic for Labour if they wanted to, for instance, get the post all owned by. All nationalised.
I mean, it could do it. It would just need to be arm's length. Government could own all the shares. That's not a problem, but it would need to be arm's length.
Excellent. Now, this is the last one. This is the last issue of the day. But I absolutely love this. It's not really anything. It kind of is to do with Brexit, but it isn't. I want to know about how the vote of no confidence works for the Conservative Party. This is, of course, linked to Theresa May being threatened with a vote of no confidence, because I think this is fascinating. This is one of those things that people can learn.
Yeah, I looked into this because there's now, again, there's talk of May being ousted or having to resign or that kind of thing, and I think Jacob Rees-Mogg is favourite, I believe.
So the Conservative Party membership.
Jacob Rees-Mogg is favourite to become Prime Minister amongst the Conservative Party membership.
I beg you not to dwell on this thought for too long, because if you thought you were outraged before...
No, not that outraged. Right, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, okay, go on.
So what is it? 1922 what?
I'll give a bit of background. So there is a body called the 1922 Committee, which you will probably at least heard of, even if you don't know what it is. It's essentially like the backbench committee.
Mm.
So those MPs, those Conservative MPs who are not on the payroll, essentially. So take away Prime Minister, all the Secretary of State, the ministers, the principal private, the principal political secretaries, the bag carriers, take all that lot out. That's what we kind of call the payroll vote, because those are people who are normally always going to vote with the government anyway. The rest form part of the 1922 Committee. The chair of the 1922 Committee is Graham Brady. Now Sir Graham Brady. He's MP for Altrincham and Sale. Alex, back to you.
So, it's just interesting the way that the system works, because it's kind of quite exciting when you learn about it. So I don't know how many votes need to be shoved. Is it?
It's a fixed percentage of the number of Conservative MPs. I can't remember what that percentage is.
Yes, but essentially how it works is you can shelve a complaint or a vote of no confidence to the 1922.
Now, I've never heard this phrase, shelving a vote.
It's essentially writing a letter. So you basically
Write a letter.
You write a letter to the chair of the 1922 saying, I'm not happy. That letter then goes on file. It sits there for as long as it needs to sit there. You can withdraw it at any point if you like. But once you've written it and not withdrawn it, it sits there. And then people start...
Yeah.
MPs send them in.
Yeah, but I think the way that this used to work was that MPs knew how many of these letters had been given in.
And they used to automatically expire, I think. 12 months.
And they used to automatically expire, yes. It's the changes which make it more exciting. So now, MPs have no idea how many letters are currently have currently been shelved. And also, the letters sit there forever until you withdraw them.
Wow.
So, the interesting point becomes, if you want to hand one of these letters in because you perhaps want to rock the boat, or you know, or you genuinely think that Theresa May should step down, or one of these things, you have no idea whether your letter is the first one or the one which, or the straw which breaks the camel's back.
That's
essentially
it. Once that threshold is reached, the Conservative Party is obligated have a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister.
This honestly sounds like something invented by Endemol for Channel 4
on
Friday nights.
Show, yeah, it sounds great. Yeah.
What's interesting, of course, is Graham Brady was on the news earlier this week, essentially desperately shouting at Tory MPs saying, calm down, which suggests we are incredibly close to the threshold.
Imagine that.
Please don't get too excited.
I mean, I know we're no proponents of game theory here, but why on earth would they set up this system?
I don't know, and of course it's an interesting, because this is the bit of politics I think often most people I'm sure don't know about is kind of the way the internal party rules work. And of course they're private bodies. Political parties are private institutions. They can set their rules up however they like. Certainly once you are elected, then the rules of the House take over. So you've got all sorts of things like, you know, the Labour Party managed to get Corbyn on the ballot last time because, frankly, you just need a certain number
Someone gave him a charity vote.
I mean, basically, and that was it. Now, the Tory one works very differently. The Tory one is always one of the parliamentary party would never let go of control in the way that the Labour Party reform the last few years have done. So the members do get the final vote. In the Tory party, but the MPs whittle it down to two. So essentially the political party always has the final say in who is presented to the membership in that.
That is absolutely fascinating. So the more worried Graham Brady is, well, the more worried everyone should be.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. Yeah, would a voting no confidence in the Prime Minister be helpful at this stage?
But what remit does he have to give his impression? I mean, you're saying that he's telling people to calm down.
Well, he's just pale.
Surely that's against the rules, or...
Well, I mean, if he's just pale and sweaty and can't get his words out.
He is on the record saying, you know, we are very, very close to the limit, and I would urge members to think carefully about what the implications of an additional...
Oh, I don't think...
So you could be an MP just thinking, I'll just hand my letter and just rock the boat a little bit. I don't really want it to go. And then the next day you could wake up and there's an automatic leadership.
Anonymous. Like, there's no point. I mean, it's not as if you're protesting openly. I'd see the political capital in it, and right, let's say, well, I've lodged my complaint now because I'm so disgusted about what you've done. But because there is no, you know, because it's all, it's weird.
That's the point. No one knows if they'll be the one to tip it, which I think is just exciting.
What an amazing system. Well, I'll finish off with this bit of Tory trivia as Ron's that. I saw a picture of Nick Timothy without his beard today.
Oh, has he got a clean shave?
Yeah, yeah. So that's
very obvious.
If
that's a market moving event, I hope you've bet on it and won the fortune.
There we go. Right. Well, we're 40 minutes in. I believe that was quite a nice little podcast. Tell us where we can find you both on social media.
I'm at @GMCC_Alex.
And usual place at @GMCC_Christian.
And at @JBeardmore if you ever would want to tweet that. All right. So until next week, we'll see you then. Goodbye.